Hi everyone, I'm Aaron Noonan and welcome along to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken, a world leader in bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now this week we sit down with a true legend of Australian motorsport. He's a guy that made it all the way to Formula One. He won the Bathurst 1000 six times, three times with his own team. He piloted a solar car across the country and found long-lost artifacts in the Aussie outback. There's nothing that this guy can't do. Of course, it's the one and only Larry Perkins. In the first part of our chat, we cover his time in Europe trying to make it to Formula One, about racing for Bernie Eccleston, and how an ice skater ended his oval track racing career before it even began. Plus, we touch on his sudden decision to retire from the cockpit for good at Bathurst in 2003. Stay tuned for part two, where we ask him your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions. We talk about his decision to start his own touring car team and his three Bathurst wins under his own banner. So, here we go. Buckle up, time to start. Part one of Larry Perkins on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken. Larry Perkins, we have been asked by so many people to drag you onto the V8 Sleuth podcast. We have finally done it. Thanks for taking some time with us today. This could go anywhere, mate. This could be a bit of anything and everything. Are you ready?
I'm ready. No problem.
Oh, is there anything off limits today?
Oh, I'll tell you when we get there.
All right. I would have expected nothing less. Because at V8 Sleuth LP, we are right into the histories of the old race cars, and obviously your team built so many over the years. The one we want to ask about and our fans want to know about right now, because it's a bit timely, is how's the restoration going of the 1993 Bathurst-winning VP Commodore?
Yeah, my favourite car, I suppose, the first one that we built, pole position and won the race, and had a Holden engine, all good things about it. How's it going? Well, Jack's been on it for me. We've had it a few years now, but the body is totally finished and painted as we had it on the grid, obviously, in 1993. The engines are in bits. That's in my corner. I've got the crankshaft out. And
so that's your job? He's the body man, you're the motor man.
Yeah. I said to Jack, I'm going to do that. It's in pretty good shape, actually, the engine, so we don't have to do a lot to it. But the gearbox is done. I think Jack got that done, one of our old mechanics, Barry Abbottmeyer, he comes in to do those parts for us and the diff and all that. So he's got all the bits, I believe.
And are these the bits from, are they the exact engine, the exact gearbox?
The exact engine, correct engine number and the correct gearbox number. It's all the right stuff. Took Jack a lot of tracking down, but he's got a good network of friends and people that follow what he does, and so he's been able to source everything. So when it hits the track or the grid or the ground, whatever we call it, finished, it'll be exactly as it was in 1993 in, what was it, October of 93, yeah.
The painstaking levels of detail that I know he's gone to, because I've been lucky enough to pop out to your workshop and have a look at it and some of the other cars there. It's off the chart, the level that he's been going to in terms of he's had fans sending photos. I think did you take that car back home many years ago on the way to the Adelaide Grand Prix? And fans had taken photos in the boot, in the engine bay, in the interior that have actually helped you know where things were or what colour that was or that lead. Or it's amazing how innocuous photos from 27 years ago now underpin the restoration of a famous car.
Yeah, it's been a lot of homework to get it right, and once we finished 93, we sold the car, you know, very quickly, if I remember rightly, because you always sold your car to finance the next car. And so it was many years past before Jack got it back, and it went through numerous owners, and a lot of them hotted it up, you know, in their own way since then. And I think they made it into the next model. And I know we've got a very good lad, Travis, who's been worked for me for many years ago, but he's worked on it almost for a year to get the body structurally as it was. He's a great fabricator, and so that's all right, but we wanted it right. There's no point in doing a restoration that's just flashy. We didn't want to just have chrome rocker covers. We wanted it as it was. And, to get the right gearbox and the right wheels and all those things has been a big task. Yeah, a lot of people have helped.
What are you going to do when you finally finish the thing? There's some people would say, stick it in a corner. It's pristine. I don't want to put it near a racetrack or get a bug squashed onto the front spoiler. When it's finished, is it going to go on the track or is it going to be wheeled away somewhere nice and parked in a corner?
Oh, no, we'd like to. I said to Jack, look, I'll help as well, as long as your goal is that it's original and structurally as it was, meaning it's got to be able to do another Bathurst. No point in having it half reconditioned. And so it'll be easily good enough to do laps on the track at some stage, of which I expect to do it, whether I drive or Jack will drive, doesn't matter much. But we certainly won't be racing it at a level that where you could risk the machinery and crash it. But to have it sitting in a corner after all that work, I think would be a bit of a waste of time. So we want to show that, it still goes good. Went good last time I ran it. It'll still go good today.
Sounds like a plan to me. We jump all over the shop with this podcast. Yes. We cover all sorts of topics. We've got our Couch Racer questions section coming up a bit later where fans have actually thrown in some questions. We had piles for you. I spent all night sifting through them to edit them down to get to the level that we could probably get through. One of the things that I've not had the chance to talk to you about, and I know other people have, but I'm really intrigued because it probably doesn't get covered enough, is the F1 stuff of your career. There's a first for everyone. There's a first Bathurst or a first Grand Prix. So am I right in saying your first Grand Prix was at the Nürburgring in 74?
Yes.
What a place to turn up to for your first F1 race.
Yes, I was very pleased to get there, to get to Nürburgring. I mean, not only get to Formula 1, but Nürburgring at for anyone who's got a few miles on the clock, the Nürburgring is the ultimate Formula One track, and I'm talking about the old Nürburgring. And I'd only been in Europe a couple of years, and I teamed up Chris Amon, a New Zealand guy, the late Chris Amon. He was starting his own team, a Cosworth-based English design car, and he was going to have two cars, of which I'd drive one, and I did testing at Goodwood a lot with him, and we went to Nürburgring mid-season because that's when it all got finished. And Chris, I think, might have drove the first session, if I remember rightly, but he got crook. He had ailment, and so I drove the next day. Ultimately, though, I did crash it in the on the track. It was I went over this particular hill at the Adenauers, and it was raining on the other side of the hill, and you can't tell this, and I speared off and banged the back into the Armco, and we didn't have any spares. We had no spares to fix it, and so it was withdrawn. So, but I before that, I had got in numerous laps at the track, and I was delighted about it.
In those days, getting into Formula One, is that okay? More talent than money back in those days, but there was a bit of money flying around. You did all your own deals. You handled everything yourself to open those doors. And how did that door crack open? Did you go and have to kick it in, or did someone come to you saying, you're a good young fella, you're going okay here, come and drive my car?
Well, when I left the farm up at Murrayville or Cowangie, that in the Mallee there, I was a windmill mechanic, and I didn't have a huge academic education. That's an understatement. And I wanted to go Formula One racing, and I did my Formula Ford bit in Australia, and it was driving for Bibb Stool, and I hung around for a year with Harry Firth and met lots of other people as well. And I remember saying, to Brocky, I said, look, I don't know why you're hanging around here to be king of the kids. Formula One's where it's gone.
That's where the bigwigs go.
And I was gone. So when I got to Europe with my own Elfin Formula Ford, as in owned by Gary Cooper, the late Gary Cooper of Elfin, which he'd loaned me for that race, and I got, I think he ended up third in the world final, doors already were opening, and I had some people were offering me free cars, etc., to drive Formula 3s, and So and I put on a good enough display to wear Chris Amon. He was good friends with other people as well who knew me. David Mackay, a well-known Australian journalist, was always on my case as being, hey, I'll be right to race Formula One. And so he was pushing barrows behind the scenes, and he was a good friend also of Chris Amon's. And I think that's probably how that particular door opened. But it opened really by the hard work that I know that I'd been doing, get on the track and display your talents. Owners want to see drivers who can get in a car and put it on the front row and win a race. And I'd been doing pretty good at that.
I reckon you did. One of the things that strikes me about the pathway to the top, no matter what the era, who the driver is, whether it's Australia or Europe, but more so I think when you hear about drivers going to Europe and England and doing those things, is the sacrifices and sleeping on floors and sleeping on a couch at a mate's place and didn't have a buck to go and stay at a hotel at that track, so they stayed in the truck or whatever it was. Give our listeners a bit of an idea of the early mid-70s there. That, was that sort of stuff going on in your world? Were you, what springs to mind from that whole type of situation?
Well, it was going on, but I didn't know there was a difference because I grew up all my life. Yeah, we were poor on the farm. We had no money, and any money I had, I earned myself. I was working. I left school when I was 14. I started working then. I paid my mum rent to live in the farmhouse, and so you lived rough all the time. And when I got to Europe, it just it was a fraction rougher. not a lot. I bought a truck. I immediately bought a truck that I could sleep in and live in, because that was going to be the cheapest way to operate. And there was just no other option. I didn't even consider that you could get money and make this easy, because I didn't have a pass for that.
It would have made it a lot easy, but it probably wouldn't have been as much fun half the time.
Well, it wouldn't have been as much fun, but the bottom line is to get where you want to be. Owners want to have drivers who can win races. It's a bonus if that driver has some money, for sure. But it didn't matter who you spoke to, whether it be Bernie Ecclestone or anyone else. They wanted a driver who could win a race. And, the second I landed in Europe, I captured a lot of, attention in the motorsport media to be able to, make the car work. My first trip to Monaco in 1973 with my GRD Formula 3 car, I got a very large write-up in the L'Equipe newspaper. It was a bigger write-up than Jackie Stewart got.
Was it in French?
It was in French.
Well, so how's your French, though? You had no idea.
I could see my name and I could see
Larry Trebian.
And that was because my first day there, I think I was the fastest Formula 3 car of all the Formula 3 cars. First time ever been to Monaco, and it was unheard of. And so they gave me a very good write-up. And that's, if you like, where it started. Get on and, don't talk about how good you are. Let the track and the lap times do the talking.
You mentioned Bernie Ecclestone. You spent a few Grand Prix with his team, Brabham, when he owned it. But predominantly you're the teams that were struggling at Surtees and Amon and the like. You would have driven some absolute shitboxes, surely, in that time. What was the car that you think, I would burn that car? It was so bad, because there was a few of them that weren't flash.
Oh, they were all terrible cars. And the Brabham was fine. But again, I joined very at the end of the season as a result of, I think it was Carlos Reutemann left Brabham for some political reasons and went to Ferrari, and there was an opening. And I had driven for Bernie 2 years before that. He loaned me a Formula 3 car, and so I knew him and he knew me, and he gave me a go. But it was still tough because we had no test days in the car. I lobbed in the car at the Canadian Grand Prix and so on. So it was all hard work, and I was still then young enough to be a bit faster than I should have been. And, I in the warm-up, I recall I I'd never run the tank on the car on full tanks of fuel, and I've, you know, in the warm up for the Grand Prix, I've hit the brakes. I recall it clearly at the Watkins Glen track, and the front hit the ground and it effectively skidded on the skid plates, and I overshot the corner and just mildly put it into the catch fence. It wasn't a big deal, but it was a mistake. And yeah, but when I was 110% on the limit all the time, and but it, in your sort of CV, it doesn't look that good. You put it in the fence. So I didn't start well with Bernie, but it went off, you know, good. I moved on then to the American Grand Prix and then the Japanese one, and I had my own car. And my first day of practice at Fuji, the first time Formula One cars are at Fuji, I was fourth fastest in the first practice session, if I remember rightly. And Parche, my teammate, was much further back, and he wanted my car, and I had to have his. And I said, "Oh no, don't take my car! I'm hanging in. I'm going to do all right here." And you know, I couldn't get his car very right in the time. And long story short, I didn't keep my drive into next year because I weren't compatible with the Martini Rossi sponsorship. They sold nothing in Australia, they said. And
you weren't very Martini special.
I weren't very Martini friendly. And anyway,
which is the one that you would have lit on fire if you had one? If we wheeled one in now and said, "This is the Formula One car you hated the most, burn that sucker." Which one is it? Because there's a choice.
It's quite a huge choice. I mean, they had the Amon Cosworth type car, the Surtees Cosworth type car,
was it the Boro?
The Boro, which was a Ensign, an English based team with the Cosworth engine. There was the BRM with the V12. There was the Brabham with the flat 12. The worst one was, you know, that they were potentially all right. I mean, a Cosworth engine, English constructed car was still all right, but yet they have a team around you that wanted to adjust it to make it into a winner, and that's why certain teams were always winners and some weren't. And I weren't necessarily with teams that were winners. And, yeah, the Surtees team was a great disappointment. And, yeah, it was just the way the teams ran the show. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Just design failures, and the BRM had shocking design failures on it. And I called talking to Aubrey Woods, the chief engineer, and that it came out, and I saw it. The radiators, they were that small, you wouldn't have put them on a mini miner. I said, "This thing won't get out of sight without boiling." And yeah, sure enough, we go to Brazil the first race, and I think it was boiling before I got to the end of the pit lane. And very predictable to an old windmill mechanic like myself, you see, off the farm. And yeah, so it was quite a learner. It was quite a learning experience to find such shocking examples of engineering and standard of some of the mechanics. I think I had seven or eight races in a row where the engine blew up, and the engines blew up in two cases because there wasn't enough oil in the oil tank.
They'll do it.
And it ran out of oil pressure around the corner. And, just silly things all the time. And that's why I suppose when I finally come back to Australia, I was determined to, I'll run it. And if it, only one person to blame then if it doesn't work.
I'm looking at him. You mentioned about Fuji, and that whole race, that Japanese Grand Prix of 76 has been put into everybody's minds, partly because of the movie Rush in more recent years. I'm sure you've been asked a lot about it. But at the time, did it seem as such a big deal as it's become? The Hunt Lauda thing for the championship was obviously a big element. Yes. The movies put a bit more caro on it all and given it a bit more zhuzh. Yeah. But at the time, did it feel like this massive moment in Formula One history, or was it just another race with a title on the line?
No, to us, to the participants, and that was about my, I don't know, 10th race or something, to go to Japan where the culture was just alien to all us European-based teams, and it felt really weird. There was sort of, you couldn't speak the language as such, whereas right through Europe, the culture of Formula One and the racing was a language all by itself, and everyone knew what was going on. But there, it seemed like we were the weirdos. What are we doing here? But, you know, obviously that's slowly turned around. And but as you said, that was the very first race in a Asian-type or Oriental-type country, you know, yeah.
And it was also the big TV spectacle at the time because television was becoming more of a thing. Mm. There's so many topics. I will skip all over the place because there's so much to cover. One of the things that came up very commonly in our questions from our fans is about Peter Jansen, and I know you had a great run with him at Bathurst there for some years when you came back to Australia, and you've been asked a million times. There's the stories about throwing the cherry ripes out the door on the warm-up laps and putting dirt on the tyres. What's your favourite Peter Jansen story that perhaps you haven't told or that no one's asked you enough about? I know that you've said previously that he was a far better driver than some people probably gave him credit for. But what's lurking in the LP files on Peter Jansen that you can wheel out for us? Because as Sleuth fans love Peter Jansen. We must get him on one day.
Well, what stood out, I mean, I don't know whether I'd met him before I went to England. I may have met him for sure. But it started his mechanic or did his engines, Ian Tate, you know, the Ian Tate we all know. Ian rang me up one day and said, Jansen's keen to, you know, run with someone like yourself, would you be interested? And I said, oh yeah, why not? So
did you ask for a big fee or did you just ask for a drive?
I was never money hungry and I wouldn't have asked. I doubt whether I even got paid, but I'd been in England then many years and I know he was sponsored by Air India and he was going to fly me everywhere. I think I had a few trips, always up the front end of the plane too, my dad. And I didn't know that even existed till then. But so once I met Jansen and I stayed at the Windsor Hotel there, I'd come out from England to do the Sandown and the Bathurst in one trip, if you know what I mean. I got to know Jansen very well and over the many years, we always got on famously well to this very day. We've never had a blue or such, never any animosity in anything we ever did. And I think it was because we were worlds apart as people. And I never encroached into his little world and he never encroached into mine. You know, he did his PR and all that stuff, you know, massively better than I could even dream of doing it. And he let me, you know, handle and work on the race cars as I saw fit. And it was a great time, you know, driving with him, working with him. As I said, that still exists today. And, you know, I got married there to Raylene, you know, the kid's mother. And that was all great. And, yeah, Yeah, but good times with Jansen. You mentioned the cherry ripe saga. That was true. We were back in those days. You must have had a passenger seat still in the race car. And at the start of in the morning of the race, you did a slow lap around the track in your race car with, you know, two of you in the race car, and I'm sitting in the passenger seat, and he's suddenly going up the hill, driven right off the bitumen onto the dirt and the grass and the sticks and the kangaroo crap and everything, throwing cherry ripes out the window to the marshals. I grabbed the steering wheel and said, get back on the bloody track. We're on our race tyres, for Christ's sake. We're going to be starting the race in, you know, 15 minutes. And he got shocked that he didn't realise he was doing anything wrong, but it didn't never caused issues, I might add. And yeah, so I had a very memorable time with Jansen here. Yeah.
And still do, you still see him, which is great stuff.
Quite often I go to his place on his Tuesday night drinks there every now and again, and we reminisce about how good it was in the old days.
How good we were.
How good we were. But you did mention, I want to say, he never got accolades of being a good driver from other peers of his. I think primarily because there was always a jealousy factor, and motoring journos tended not to take him seriously, but in our four Bathursts we did, which 2 seconds and a third, and a DNF, he never put a foot wrong and always handed the car over to me. We never, you know, he would say, well, who should start? Should you start the race? I said, Peter, it's your car, your team, nothing wrong with you. You do, you start the race. And so we didn't have any ego issues, and I don't believe his pace as such ever was the reason for a deficient result. He just got on with it, and for a guy who didn't appear to eat at all and certainly drank a bit, I thought it was a remarkable effort.
Wasn't just Schweppes either, by the way. I would have thought. Yeah. Tell me about the solar car. One that probably doesn't get covered enough with you, but you were heavily involved in putting that together. Just for those who don't know, when was it? Why did you do it? And what was the whole point?
Well, when I finally came back from England, that's in living there, I just mentioned Janssen, which was 1977 I did it. I didn't do 78 because I was doing, I think I might have been doing a Formula 2 race or something like that in Europe. So I did 79, then 80 and 81. Then I was between jobs. I'd come back to Australia to live full time and around about at 1980, and thought, well, what am I going to do now? And amongst scratching my head and doing a bit of nothing and few withdrawal symptoms coming from I'd placed my whole life on hold to do Formula One, and it wasn't going to happen. It was all over. So I was between things, and I was talking to Hans Tolstrup at one stage, or he was talking to me, and it was just after they flew the English Channel with a solar-powered machine, and Hans said, look, we got to do something with solar power. What can we do? And I said, well, like, what do you mean? Do you want to build a car or drive around Australia? What do you want to do? He said, yeah, that'd be great.
So you dubbed yourself in, basically.
Yeah, so he said, well, could we do that? I said, well, hang on, give us a couple of hours. And I did some bits of numbers on how much power you could get, et cetera, et cetera. I said, yeah, we can build a car and drive across Australia if you want. It'd be struggling to, average more than 25 kilometres an hour. But
it'll go.
So he said, okay. So we walked into BP and asked them for $50,000, and in 5 minutes' time they gave us the $50,000, and I walked out and said, Jesus,
we didn't
ask for enough, I built the car up at in various places it was, but principally I put it together. My brother Gary helped me on that, and in Ringwood, that Jack Godbehere, late Jack Godbehere, a good old friend of mine, I built it in his barn, and we tested it out at the Army Proving Ground with simulation of solar cells for drag. I didn't have the solar cells were made by a company BP owned, and they didn't arrive till we got the vehicle in Perth. And the boss of BP...
And the plan was to go Perth to Melbourne?
Yeah. We drove to... The plan was to go Melbourne, Perth to Sydney. And all the others around were stressing that, how do you know it'll work? I said, I was good at maths at school, which is true, actually. It'll work. And, so the solar cells arrived. We put them on over there, and it worked.
So how many days does it take to drive a solar-powered car that's got a top speed of, 25 k's an hour from Perth to Sydney? You'd grow a fair beard in that time, wouldn't you?
When I say, I think it was an average of 25 we did. It had a top speed down some of the hills. I know we were up around 70 or 80 k. It was a bit scary, I might add.
Narrow tyres, I guess, as well.
Yeah, they were on a nice little high-speed Michelin pushbike tyres. But Hans did the logistics of the planning.
What was his background for those who maybe
Hans,
don't know Hans
Solstrup? I don't know what his CV said, but he's a Dutchman who came out to Australia to flee the country of socialism and everything, because he's a can do. He just wants to do things. He doesn't want a handout from anyone. Wants to do things. So he's a doer. Some people call him an adventurer. That may be right. He'd wake up one morning and want to walk across the Simpson Desert, and he'd do it. He wouldn't. Procrastinate. So that was his background, and he had planned the trip to take, I think, around 24 days, and we ended up in Sydney after 15 days. So we were about 8 days faster than he had thought. So that was a success, if you know what I mean. And We then had planned to donate the vehicle to the Australian National Museum, and which was a great pity. So I got a call one night in the middle of the night from the company. They said, the Smithsonian Institute. I said, the Smithsonian, are you sure that's who you are? And he said, yeah, we'd like to buy the vehicle. I said, well, I can't do. It's already gone. So not many people in the world get a call from the Smithsonian Institute.
I think you're the first person on our podcast to get a call from them.
So anyway, it was a fill-in job, simple as that. That's why I did that.
It filled in quite nicely because then the next little chapter delivered three Bathurst wins in a row with Brock and the dealer team.
Yeah.
Tell me now, I've never heard the straight story on this. This is your chance to tell it.
Right.
There was a yarn that popped up in the paper and in the media in the mid-80s about a HDT Commodore that was speeding across town, and there was all sorts of accusations and things. Can you straighten out all that story? Because it's taken on a whole new thing over, 30-odd years as to who did what, where, why, and how, and to what level. And it's not quite at O.J. Simpson chase levels, but can you straighten out the story on what happened there or what didn't happen there or what people are saying is incorrect about all that?
I recall a Sunday morning I've walked in to fill my petrol car up with petrol, and I walked in to pay it, and I think they had the Truth newspaper around then, and the newspapers were sitting on the counter.
And we're talking mid-80s here, aren't we?
Yeah, and whatever the newspaper was, it had my photo, full-blown photo on the front page, my head saying, was this the guy the police were chasing? And I looked at it and thought, Jesus.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. I don't know much about this. And so I read that with interest, and over the next 9 months I constantly had the police knocking on my door at home and everywhere else saying, we know it was you. We've chased you everywhere that many times. And I'm saying, hey, guys, there's something wrong here. Long story short, I went to court, and they had 13 witnesses who recognised me as the driver of the vehicle the police were chasing.
Of a road car, of a road HDT car. Spec Commodore.
Well, it was a road car, and they recognised me because of my moustache. And the court had, they were presenting large, Tim Pemberton posters up, with me and Bob Hawke and Peter Brock on the
the podium at Bathurst. And Tim Pemberton, the long-time Holden PR guy.
Yeah, with my moustache. Now, I said to my lawyer, but I didn't have a moustache. And he said, can you prove it? I said, well, of course I can. I said, my daughter was born 2 weeks before the alleged chase, and I've got 10,000 photos of me holding my first child, Nicola, my daughter. And no moustache, and that went. Those photos covered the whole, first month. Yeah, so we go to court, and eventually I produced the photos because I was giving evidence. And the judge says, "Well, when were the photos taken?" So I turned them over. He said, "No, don't turn them over. Tell me." I said, "Oh, 1983." He said, "Well, the case was in 1984." Oh, I said, "Well, I meant to say 84," which I made an error. Now, I wouldn't be the first male father to not know when his daughter was born. And he said, no, you said what you said. And I could not believe it. I was convicted then on all the evidence was false evidence. But I was convicted. So that's the story, and that's the story that is the truth. And that's as far as I'm going to say.
Righto. Fair enough. No, we got you further than I think most other people have. So there you go. One other thing that springs into my mind, Will Dale, who works with us at V8 Sleuth, he is manning the audio as we speak here, has a great view of history, and he delves through the things that I forget sometimes. One of the things that actually popped up in one of our questions was a fan asked if you ever had the tendency to want to have a go at the Thunderdome, at Oscar racing, and you were supposed to, but a world-famous figure skater smashed the crap out of your car.
That's right.
So Torval and Dean were the massive stars of the 80s of ice skating and Winter Olympics, and Christopher Dean was a bit of a fan of car racing. How did it come to be that he was driving a Perkins Engineering Commodore at the Thunderdome and walloped it? So you couldn't actually take part in the race.
I'm not exactly sure how we, if you like, got connected. Probably something that it was
because you're a big ice skating fan, LP.
Yeah, maybe because I'm a big ice skating fan. Like not. We had the car prepared to do Thunderdome, and must have been going to do, I don't know whether it was a demonstration or a race before the race or whatever.
I think that's what the plan was,
And long story short, he was a decent guy. I got on well with him, and he's offsider, what's her name?
Was it Jane Torval. Yeah. Was she there to go?
It was Torval and Dean. Yeah, I never
Jane
know
Torval.
Which.
Christopher Dean, Jane Torval.
Yeah, she was perfectly sensible. And we met them. He crashes the car and he ends up in hospital and so on. And but the car was very much in hospital as well, so I didn't get to do the drive. But that was my first and last go at anything to do with ice skating or the Thunderdome or anything like that.
Very short, sharp it chapter was, of the LP racing career. The Lotus Esprit, that's one people have forgotten. The Bathurst 12-hour, you didn't do too many 12-hours. I think that's the only one you might have done. How did that come to be? Because it was a very straight, thinking back, we connect you to Formula One, to Holden primarily, one little dirty run in a Ford Mustang with a certain Queensland bloke that we won't go into for the Holden fans. But how did you end up in a Lotus? It's one of those oddities.
Well, I must admit I'm not exactly sure how I ended up, but a good friend of mine was Ron Barnicle. And Ron, I think, was probably he was a bit more connected to that world that I was, and would I want to do the 12-hour with him? I said, oh, yeah, why not? And importers of that Lotus I knew from long time back, and I thought, oh, yeah, this will be all right. I was very pleased to do it. We were running around in the race. We were relatively competitive.
I think you got pole, didn't you?
I got this feeling we had pole. And,
go with it anyway.
We'll live with that. And that's effectively how I signed up Greg Hansard, because he was driving some other machine. I recall following him.
It's a Mazda, you can say it.
Was it a Mazda?
RX-7 Mazda. I thought you were avoiding it because you just didn't want to mention the name.
I don't care about that. But I remember following him closely for many, many laps. And because I was aware that it was a 12-hour race, and you didn't have to pass the guy and win in the first corner. So his pace was very, very good. And I thought, I'll just follow him from see how it goes. And over those many, many laps, he never, ever made a mistake. His line, the first lap was the same as his last lap, etc. And when I finished my stint or that meeting finished, eventually the Lotus failed, the back brakes smoked up or something, and it didn't finish. But I immediately contacted Greg and asked him, what's he doing at Bathurst? Because I'd got a seat for him whenever he wants it. And that's how I met dear old Greg, and the rest is history on that, unfortunately.
Yeah. It worked out good that year, though, because
it worked out very good.
Went back to Bathurst 6 months later and won the race, and now the car's being restored, which is how we started our podcast.
Correct.
One of the ones that our fans love is the VL, the fuel-injected Walkinshaw VL Group A Commodore. And I think, if I'm right, that 1990, it did a couple of years, that car, and it was white, it was red, and then it was the Bob Jane T-Mart's car that won the Sandown 500. Is that car's in your workshop, is it not?
It was in our workshop. It's owned by a Sydney guy, Dave Gardner, I hope I've got that right. He brought it down for some mechanical work, etc. It sat in our workshop for 2 or 3 months there, I know, and Jack and Travis Langman worked on it and did various things. It wasn't the extensive job that I've done on our own, because he didn't want that, if you know what I mean. And we had that model humming pretty good, because that was the rules again suited some elements of what we were doing. That was a stage of free engine revs. You could run to 8,500, which is all the cylinder block would take on the Holden, and you'd start breaking rear main bearings and things like that. And that's why when we it led to the 93 engines and blocks that I made with the fuel injection. We had great support from Holden from holding the engine shop and the management to do what we wanted to do, but we didn't have great any support from the marketing side where all the dollars were. They didn't like me taking the Castrol money from the race, from the factory race team, so I was frozen out. But a good little era there where a lot of hands-on work from myself and our small team, we were able to think a bit outside the bubble, use the rule book to our advantage, and weren't just going to go and copy someone.
Because that VL by 92, the last year, actually you raced that into 93 before you got your VP ready. So that model of car actually came on the scene in 88. So it had a really long period time in which time you'd gone to VNs with Brock coming along and doing a year with the mobile thing. Then that all finished and you went back to your old VL. So it was like this trusty old steed that just kept on keeping on. I don't know how you kept finding ways to – what did you do to it to make it keep on performing up against the Sierras and the Skylines and the BMWs that were all either highly horsepowered or highly tired because the Commodore was kind of deficient in most of the areas on paper?
You're right, and it was, but it was under those Group A rules, if
your
I remember
favorite,
rightly.
Your favourite era.
A shocking era of motorsport. Group A, run by a bunch of Frenchmen who were all corrupt, in my view, aided and abetted by equally incompetent people that used to work for CAMS.
We've got – how many minutes, Will, have we got in before Larry's given CAMS one? Well, they're not CAMS anymore. They're Motorsport Australia, so it doesn't count, does
it? Yeah, they've always – I've asked many people who are so-called friends of CAMS, give me a list of the good things CAMS have done, and I end up with a blank paper. But anyway, that's not the individuals, that's just the big picture. There's a lot of good individuals in CAMS, I might add, who really mean well and work hard, but, you know, sometimes I really question the whole vision of CAMS.
Well, we didn't even get onto that one. One thing that popped up too, Marcus Ambrose was supposed to test for you. Do you remember that?
No.
Yeah. He talked about it on a podcast with our good friend Greg Russ that he was going to have a test and then he had to sheepishly can it because he'd gone and done a deal with the Stone Brothers.
Oh, yeah, I do remember something about that.
History could have been very different.
Well, that could have been. Yeah, it could have been, but look, they didn't. I think we were getting because I knew Marcus's dad from England, Ross Ambrose, who was very big in Formula Fords.
Van Diemen.
Yeah, he was a partner in the Van Diemen company. And so I knew all about him, and I thought to myself, anyone who's had a go over there will always be good, you know. And I know we had some talks, and I just weren't quite sure why it fizzled out. Any talks I ever had with drivers fizzled out pretty quick when I offered them the wage I was offering. And but, yeah, that's the way it is.
Who drove the hardest bargain? I mean, you didn't have lots of – when you went to two cars, so you had Russell Ingall, Steve Richards came along a bit later, Port Umbrella was with you for a time. Who drove the hardest bargain out of anyone that you had to do the deal with to come and drive for you? Surely it was Russell.
Russell's view on life is he wanted always more than I wanted to pay him, and that I didn't have a problem with that. But that was out in the open. He knew, you know, we knew that, and eventually, you know, he moved on. And that's fine. There was an era there after about the time I retired from driving that, you know, the teams were all whinging about how much it cost, but those very teams were all then paying their drivers ridiculous amounts of money. And I had sponsors who were saying to me, well, we'll sponsor you, but, you know, you got to have what's called a top-line driver, and they were costing between $600,000 and $900,000 a year. And I recall talking to some of them, I won't mention those.
Come on now, it's so long ago, it doesn't matter.
I said, look, I'll pay you $1 million a year, and there's 15 races, and you've got to guarantee me 15 wins. And quickly the driver said, oh, no, that's not fair.
Now, you said driver then, so you must have only had this chat with one.
I said,
who were you trying to lure?
No, I did have a driver. He wanted to maintain a high wage. And I said, well, you got to do things for me as well. I mean, I'll pay you, but you better win some races. And each time you don't win, we'll nip some out of you. They weren't too keen on that
funny
discussion.
That.
Yeah, funny that, yeah.
Was there anyone you had serious chats with along the way in your V8 team to come and drive for you or to get involved that perhaps it didn't pan out, or did you always get the guy that you wanted?
Well, in those later years, money then started dictating who I could afford. And I recall, for instance, after I retired, I'd run Jack, my son, and Shane Price in the DVS, and I rang up Jack Daniels and I rang up Holden. I said, look, I want to save myself $1.5 million a year. Can I hire two, development series drivers? They're young, and both sponsors said, absolutely go for it. So I just saved that much money. It wasn't funny. And I recall Ross Stone ringing me after I had hired my $50 a year flex. Ross said, well, I wish I had the balls to do that, anyway, that's what happens. And it didn't work out, unfortunately, for them for various reasons. And but that's how life is,
When you stopped with the race team and that all wound up and the Kellys sort of kind of took over what there was, Jack had a drive there and bits and pieces. Did you go cold turkey on the car racing thing for a while because it was just time to do some other things, or did you keep an interest all the way through?
Oh, no. Once I stopped driving, it was an easy decision because some of the biggest decisions are very easy. I'd always said to myself and my team that the moment I become a weak link in the team, I've got to look at myself like I'd look at anyone else. And I'd made that mistake in 2003 race, my last Bathurst in practice. I plowed it into the wall while I was arguing with Joe, my team manager, who wanted me to come in and sign a letter of indemnity to indemnify CAMS and V8 supercars against negligence, and I was refusing to do that. And so I weren't arguing with Joe. Joe was saying, hey, they're going to black flag you and they might fine you, et cetera, et cetera. So I was totally out of concentration mode. That's why I had that crash. And, and then I was, starting to not be on the front row of the grid how I, in some earlier years, would have been. So I thought, hang on, time to pack it up. So that's why I backed out. I forget what the question was there. What was it?
You made me forget it now too. We talked about maintaining your interest in the sport when you sold the team. And
no, so when I then sold out the Kellys, et cetera, once I was out of racing, and I very quickly had moved on to do other things. I mean, I've always watched it on TV, but not every second and every lap of it. So nothing's altered in that. Even of today, I'll miss the odd race if I'm doing something else. Like, I don't make it a priority, but I haven't, turned my back on it. I just, my part's out. I'm over. I'm, like the cricket man, he's out. Go back and sit in the pavilion, do your own thing, Let someone else do it.
That's part one of our chat with Larry Perkins on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. Stay tuned for part two where we ask him your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions. We talk about his decision to start his own touring car team, his three Bathurst 1000 victories under his own banner, the all-female Castrol Cougars program, and the V8 Sleuth Top 10 shootout as well, where Larry comes out with a few ripping answers. There's also a fair bit of LP in our latest book project too, which is now available to pre-order in the V8 Sleuth online store. Racing the Lion is a 400-page illustrated history of Holden in Australian motorsport. It's our dip of our lid to the general and its rich history in our sport. To get your copy, jump on our website, v8sleuth.com.au, click on the store link, and you can guarantee you'll get a copy of this limited edition release when it comes out later this year. Now, if you're enjoying our podcast, make sure to leave us a review to help spread the word. And don't forget to subscribe to make sure you don't miss episodes as they're released. And there'll be plenty more of them this year too. We will be releasing an episode every single week during the 2020 Supercar season. If you haven't been to our website recently, we've given it a birthday and a new livery. Check it out at v8sleuth.com.au. And as always, keep an eye on our social pages on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram to stay up to date. Until then, we'll catch you next time on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken.